comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here. There are 196 countries on this planet, and people in 143 are listening to the show tonight. This is the week before Christmas. It is the day before Hanukkah. And in all those many countries, there are great, great, great many numbers of people who celebrate both Hanukkah and or Christmas. So happy Hanukkah and Merry Christmas. And we're looking forward to having a great week this week. I think it's, and we're going to, we're kicking it off tonight with Stanton Friedman. I think it's going to be a fantastic week. We've got some great guests lined up. I hope you'll be with us each and every night. Now, because it is the holiday season, we are this week providing our TV channel free of charge. That means, you know, it's always free to listen to the show, and it is, after all, a radio show. But this week, you get to watch the show each and every night, even if you're not a member of our members community. Normally, you got to be a member of the members community, and you can take care of that. I mean, look, it's 25 cents a day. Come on. But you can join tonight. We'll give you the first 7 days free. But this week is free for everybody because I want to be able to say to the whole world, Merry Christmas. No way possible for me to send each and every person on the planet a gift for Christmas. I couldn't afford it, and I couldn't even afford the postage. But we can give you our TV channel for free this week, and I hope you'll avail yourself of it and enjoy it. We've got a lot of stuff happening in the news, not just UFO stuff. Yes, that's happening. But there's just a whole lot of news out there about new discoveries in physics and astrophysics and astrobiology, futuristic kind of stuff. I can't think of anybody better to talk to about it than our guest tonight, and we're certainly going to be doing that. And we're also going to get an update from our guest, Stanton Friedman, on what's hot in his research right now. So this is going to be a one of those high-powered road gear shows. We are going to open the telephone lines in the second hour, and I hope you'll avail yourself of the opportunity to call in and talk with Stanton Friedman, ask him your questions, and get your answers. We'll make that possible, as I say, in the second hour, and you can go ahead and warm your fingers up right now, get them warmed up, get that telephone charged up, and be ready to rock and roll. The K-Files was a little bit late going out this weekend because we had lots and lots of work to do in the members community. That got done, and the K-Files got sent. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you're not subscribed, why not? That's absolutely free. When you're looking at my webpage, just look for the word K-Files right in the middle of your screen. Click it and subscribe. We'll be back right after this with our guest, Stanton Friedman, so hang in there. All right. right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is someone known to absolutely everybody in our audience, Stanton Friedman. Stanton Friedman, welcome back to the show. We're delighted to have you.
Glad to be here. Wish I was in the same temperature you are, but...
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm not in Phoenix anymore.
Oh, where are you?
I am somewhere on Earth, and it's cold.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's cold. And in fact, where I am, we have already had snow, and I expect there will be more tonight. But anyway, it seems like every year, right about Christmas, we have you on the show. And I noticed that today, and I assure you, it's not something that's pre-planned. It just works out that way. But so it's kind of a Christmas present for people, I guess. Oh, well.
Wait.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It sounded like you hung up. Okay.
Not me.
Well, you know, usually you, when you're on the show, you and I talk about flying saucers quite a bit, and we'll get to that tonight. And there's a lot of stuff in the news about that. But there's some other stuff in the news that is really kind of futuristic science that I want us to talk about because, you know, you're not... you are a UFO flying saucer researcher and writer and speaker, but that's not all you are. You are a nuclear physicist who researches flying saucers and writes about these amazing phenomena. And so it's kind of the nuclear physicist hat that we need you to wear for a few minutes while we talk about some stuff here. I want to hear from the science point of view, from the nuclear physicist point of view about this stuff. Now, one of the things that's in the news, and I've talked about it several times, is NASA's plan for what they're calling the 100-year starship. They held a symposium September 30th through October 2nd. In Orlando, Florida, and they had scientists from universities and business and from NASA centers and so forth. And the whole idea was to come up with ideas to sort of move these scientists toward breakthrough technologies and see if they couldn't come up with a way to do this 100-year starship. So it's not that they're building this thing right now, but it's, you know, it's in the concept stage. And this article that I'm looking at points out that Alpha Centauri is the nearest star to our sun. It would, at the speed of light, take us 4 years to get there if we were traveling at the speed of light. Now, one of the statements that's in this article that I want to ask you about says that any object with mass, such as a spacecraft, would have to travel significantly slower according to the laws of conventional physics. Why? Why couldn't a spacecraft be propelled at the speed of light?
You know, and there's a lot of stuff wrapped up in that simple question. One of the things is that people have the mistaken concept that since your mass increases as you move get closer to the speed of light, that it would take more and more energy to get you moving. That's assuming you've got to accelerate something, the craft. But if you are using something like nuclear fusion, where the particles are born at very high velocity, very high energy, then that it doesn't increase the mass of those particles. You'd think, well, it takes more and more energy because you're getting heavier and heavier. But that's not the way it works. If you use stuff And I should mention, fusion sounds like one of those exotic words. It really isn't. It's the most important source of energy in all our lives. The sun and the other stars out there produce their energy. I'm talking billions and trillions of stars now, produce their energy by nuclear fusion. And if you use the right stuff in the right way, you kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. You're not accelerating them to that high velocity. They're born that way. And so it makes an entirely different kind of notion. And, you know, that when you mentioned how long it takes, you have to say, in whose time frame? The guys doing the traveling or the guys staying back home? You know, the old twin paradox. And if you go out at close to the speed of light, when you come back, you will be younger than the twin brother you left back home. You go out, come back, marry your granddaughter's best friend, etc. I mean, it's the gift of immortality. So there's a lot of theorizing based on assumptions which may not be accurate at all. And the history of science is full of those assumptions. There was a guy who proved in the mid-20s, Dr. Bickerton from New Zealand, the physicist. He gave a talk at the British Association for the Advancement of Science in which he proved that it would be impossible, using our best explosive, to get anything to the speed, the escape velocity from the Earth. He proved that. Of course, he was wrong. You don't need to get the propellant to this to escape velocity. You want to get the rocket to. So you throw it out. It's the payload you want, in other words. And the history of science, of propulsion schemes, if you will, is loaded with these kind of false notions. That was in the 20s. In 1941, Dr. Campbell, an astronomer, fiction stuff about going to the moon. So he was going to show how stupid that was by calculating the required initial launch weight of a rocket, chemical rocket, able to get a man to the moon and back. Pages of equations. He published a, quote, scientific, unquote, article. And he concluded it would have to weigh a million tons. He was a little high.
Yeah.
Our first rocket to the moon only weighed 3,000 tons at liftoff. He was off by a factor of 300 million. I mean, just a little mistake here, there, and everywhere. He made all the wrong assumptions. And that's the basis that we have to watch out for. What are the underlying assumptions? He, for example, assumed a single-stage rocket. We don't do it that way. He assumed much too low an exhaust velocity. He assumed that the rocket would have to provide all the energy. He didn't know anything about cosmic freeloading. All our deep space trips, we take advantage of gravitational fields. I mean, we don't need to put them there. The moon's got a nice gravitational field. Launch at the right time, and the moon will do part of the work for you. It goes on. He assumed you have to carry a retro rocket to slow you down when you're coming back. We don't. We use the atmosphere to slow us down. You got to be smart. You got to get the angle right, or you're in deep trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, you could also use
about limitations.
You could also use gravity to slow you down.
Well, you're speeding up with the Earth's gravity, but you could use the moon too. We use cosmic freeloading for all our deep space travel. And, in other words, being smart is more important than being powerful.
Okay, so let me ask you this question.
I am very wary, especially of pronouncements made by physicists and astronomers as opposed to aerospace engineers, who have always been doing stuff that the other guy said, oh, that couldn't be done. No, no. They forget that it's the assumptions that matter.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, can I go from where I live in Fredericton, New Brunswick, to California in 12 hours? Well, I can't. I can only walk 3 miles an hour. Look how long it's going to take me. Well, I don't have to walk. I can get an airplane to someplace and get another airplane and get out there.
Sure.
So the assumptions are what matters. And that's where you usually find the flaws in the arguments of the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them. You know, if we listened to them, we'd still be in sailboats. You know, I have one of my books is Science Was Wrong. And there are 14 chapters, each one of them devoted to a smart guy saying something stupid, which got in the way of progress. And it happened over and over again, and a lot of those things were about flight. Space travel is utter bilge, said the British Astronomer Royal, less than 2 years before we put up, before the Russians put up Sputnik. So you got to be very wary of the hypothetical, theoretical, not based on reality assumption.
All right, so let me ask you a question about this this concept. First of all, let's take this trip to Alpha Centauri. And you've described before how long it would take for us to get to the speed of light with a spacecraft. So let's talk about getting a spacecraft to the speed of light and to Alpha Centauri. Are we looking at a four-year journey, or are we looking at a journey that would be 20 to 50 years?
No, we're much less than that. At 1G acceleration, and we can all stand 1G because you're standing it right now, the force of gravity at the surface of the Earth. That keeps you glued to your chair so you don't fly off space. At 1G, it only takes a little less than a year to get close to the speed of light. And so at 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go 37 light. Forget about this 4 light years routine. You can go 37 light years in 6 months pilot time. Pilot time. And that's not talking about warping space and time, you know, or anything like that. Nothing really far out. And we can all stand 1G. At 2Gs, it only takes 6 months to get close to the speed of light. So, you know, you design your trips around good, sensible aerospace engineering ideas. And a good example of that, we have the Cassini spacecraft up at Saturn. It's been there for several years, making all kinds of wonderful observations. It's got a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, so the power supply is pretty darn good. We don't need to worry about, gee, sunlight isn't very strong when you get out there. And when we fired that off, it went toward Venus, went around Venus, got a free kick to bring it past the Earth, got another free kick to put it out past Jupiter, and then that kicked it over toward Saturn. Saving one heck of a lot of energy as opposed to saying taking off from Earth and let's head toward Saturn now. Well, we want to save energy. Energy costs you, especially when you're using dumb old chemical rockets, which is what we're using. So, you know, we haven't made the big step in space travel that we have made, that the Navy has made. You know, the Navy decided to go nuclear a long time ago. Because there's more energy per pound of uranium than there is per pound of rocket fuel.
Sure, sure.
So, to give you an example, we now have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can operate for 18 years without refueling. That's pretty neat. Now, you can't do that with a chemical rocket, with a chemical reactor, with a chemical power plant pushing it forward. But you can nuclear. That's only fission, not fusion. So, you know, Admiral Leahy, one of President Truman's advisors, when he heard about the nuclear program, the Manhattan Project, to develop nuclear explosives, he said, look, I'm an expert at explosives. This will never work. He was wrong. Flat out, unquestionably wrong.
Yes, he was.
And so you got to be really careful about the nasty, noisy negativists.
All right. We've got about 2.5 minutes here till we hit the break, so let me ask you this. I know you worked on nuclear-powered rockets back in the 60s.
Yes.
Is it possible in black projects that they have developed these nuclear-powered rocket engines that could do what you're talking about doing, getting to the speed of light?
The fission rockets that I worked on wouldn't do it. They were pretty impressive. These were tested in the late 60s, incidentally. Three different groups, Westinghouse Astronuclear, where I worked, Los Alamos National Lab, and Aerojet General, we each built one. The Los Alamos was the biggest one, and it operated, get set for this, at a power level of 4,400 megawatts. That's twice Hoover Dam. It was less than 8 feet in diameter. And the exhaust temperature was like a little over 4,000 degrees. And it worked. But they canceled the program because nobody has guts enough to start using nuclear power on the top of one of the rockets, even though we use them under the water, all over the place, and on the water.
Yeah, but what if they didn't, they canceled the project. What if they took it into the black world?
Good question.
And developed it.
Good question. It wouldn't surprise me if something like that were possible. There have been loads of black programs, after all. The stealth aircraft only spent $10 billion in 10 years. I have no inkling that that happened, but I can't say it didn't, because we have a long history of very highly classified projects. So I won't rule it out. And I'm talking about the late 60s, so they've had plenty of time to up the ante, so to speak.
Yeah, and that was my point. My point was, you know, that it seems to me to be entirely possible that in all of this time they could have taken that work that was done by your group and those other groups, developed it, and we may actually have spacecraft out there capable of making that trip to Alpha Centauri.
Well, you know, there's a big rumor going around the internet, of course, where all kinds of rumors circulate all the time.
Hate to do it. We'll have to hear about the rumor when we come back, but we will. We'll pick up right there with the rumor. We have a break taking over. Ladies and gentlemen, we shall return right after this.
And you're listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Stanton Friedman. And Stanton, when we had to step away for break, you were just about to tell us about a rumor that's all over the internet. And I think it's about some kind of propulsion system or something.
Well, they did it the simple way. They just jumped there. They put them in a room and they were teleported there. Back in the early 80s, and Barack Obama was one of the people that went to Mars, it says here in small print. No evidence was added to the story, but, you know, you just wave your hand and off you go. That would be the easy way. I don't know how to do that, and I certainly have no reason for saying it's true. But exciting concept. Wouldn't that make things different if we could do that?
Well, and I'll tell you something. I fully expect that being able to transport someone will eventually be possible. I'm not sure that it's possible now. I'm pretty sure that it's not possible now, but it might be someday. I'm pretty sure they'll develop that. But, you know, it's an interesting story. I read that about Barack Obama being having spent time at base on Mars through that system you're talking about. But, okay, now, here's what I'm wondering about this propulsion system. And here's where I've been headed with all of this. Just a couple of weeks ago, NASA made a huge announcement. And the huge announcement they made was that the Kepler had found and they had confirmed the discovery of an Earth-like planet. Earth-like in that it's in a habitable zone around a star very similar to ours. And I believe it's about 1.5 times the size of Earth. They're calling it Kepler-22b. And they say it is in the habitable zone, and they're pretty excited about it. They confirm that it is a discovery. But here's... go ahead.
Well, I'm rather skeptical because they say it's in the habitable zone. That, again, is based on a number of assumptions. We don't know the density of the planet. We don't know the surface gravity of the planet. We do know its distance from the star.
Yeah.
But that isn't all it takes.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2.5 times the diameter of the Earth.
2.5.
Which means it could be 15 times as heavy, or it could be 5 times as heavy, in which case the surface gravity would be maybe too low to retain the gases. So I found it, I think that was a sales pitch, if you'll pardon my being cynical, but we know very little about the planet. It's nice, it's a good way to try to get money for the SETI guys who are looking for some place to look for. You know, they're going to look at the stars, the planets that Kepler has picked up on. But it's going to be quite a while before we know enough about it to say really that there could be life there. And I think it's hilarious, actually. That star is 600 light years away. Okay, within 54 light years of here, there are about 1,000 stars. So if you add 100 light years, there's about 8,000 stars. Now, why is anybody worrying about 600 light years away? We're going to listen for what? They're sent a signal that's going to take 600 years to get here using technology appropriate to our primitive radio, pardon my saying this, but our primitive radio technology?
That's true.
How would they know what it was unless they'd been here? You know, it's one of those convoluted kind of bits of reasoning. If we forget the things that are most important, we can make it sound like, wow, that's where we want to go for lunch, you know. But we don't know that at all. And I can't get excited about a planet 600 light years away. As you know, in my book, Captured, with Kathleen Martin, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience, we talk about Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, which are 39 light years away and are only an eighth of a light year apart from each other and a cool billion years older than the sun. Both sun-like stars, those two stars.
And
so
traveling.
That's of far more interest to me than a hypothetical, maybe like Earth, maybe not, planet that's 600 light years away, and we're not going there for lunch, I'll tell you that. So I think that was a great sales pitch effort, but I think it was lacking in reality. There are plenty of planets. I don't doubt that there are loads of planets out there, although if you go back 40 years, the astronomers were saying there aren't any other planets out there because we haven't seen any.
Yeah.
And the first guys to discover exoplanets were laughed at. You'll never be able to see that. Do you realize how remarkable Kepler is? You can pick up a planet. You can measure the slightest difference in the output coming from that star because of the planet going in front of the star, between you and the star. It's remarkable. You know, it's like seeing a firefly miles away in front of a headlight.
Yeah. All right. So, but now Zeta Reticuli. Let's talk.
Appreciate the physics.
Let's talk about Zeta Reticuli for a moment. You said it's what, 39 light years away?
39.3. Yes, they're two stars, both sun-like. A cool billion years older than the sun, both of them, and they're 30 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. So we're out in the boonies.
Okay, so if they left Zeta Reticuli headed to Earth, traveling at the speed of light, as you described earlier, it would take them just over a year pilot time to get here. That's not long.
Yeah. No, it isn't. It isn't long at all. And so I think it's much more practical to look at those. Now, I am not knocking the Kepler, but let me point out the Kepler can't look around outside its orbit, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
It can look at these same stars. It's a marvelous piece of machinery. I'm very impressed with it. It's looking at a chunk of the sky about the size of your fist at arm's length.
Mm-hmm.
A very tiny portion of the sky.
Yeah.
But there's loads of stars in that tiny portion of the sky. And
all
some
right.
of them are sun-like, and some of them have planets. Lots of them have planets.
Now, let's move back to Earth for a moment. And there's a related story. Now, here's how it's related. It's related. I'm looking kind of at these stories from the standpoint of new exotic propulsion systems. Okay? Now, there's a story that's out there now. This is not just internet. It's in the news that the astronomers or astrophysicists have discovered that there is a ring of antimatter, more specifically antiprotons, that has recently been discovered around the Earth. Now, it's not a new ring, obviously, but it is a new discovery. And it's principally inside the Van Allen radiation belts. Okay, now, this article says that these antiprotons can persist for several minutes or even hours before annihilating with normal matter. Why is that possible? You would think
there isn't much matter up there.
Well,
in other words, the density of the particles is very low.
Okay.
The more particles, the more likely to have collisions.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let me ask.
LHC.
Yeah, let me ask this then. Wouldn't the presence of antimatter in the Van Allen belts make it more dangerous to send a rocket through there?
More dangerous than what? Than if it wasn't there?
Yes. What if your rocket's going through there and runs into antimatter?
Well, what if it runs into matter? It depends what that matter is. The skin of the rocket will absorb a great deal of radiation. It's like alpha particles are radiation. A piece of cardboard will absorb those. Now, if they were gamma rays, which are sort of like high-speed X-rays, then you're in trouble because they penetrate through everything much more than protons. Charged particles don't go very far in matter. In space, where there ain't much going on, they can go for a long time.
Okay, but maybe we have a misconception.
It makes it any more dangerous. In other words, when you're driving out on the road, you got bicycles, you got big trucks, you got small cars. You got quite a variety of stuff going on. It's the same in space. We got these very highly penetrating things like gamma rays, X-rays. Then you got protons and antiprotons, and a few other. There's a bunch of stuff up there, really. But it doesn't make it any more dangerous.
Well, the concept I think that most of us have of antimatter is that when it comes into contact with matter, it explodes.
Well, exploding is not really quite right. It gives up its energy. they do a little dance together, and they both go on their merry way. But it's not, you've heard of people talking about antimatter explosives. Yes, so matter, antimatter is great for propulsion of a rocket, too. The trouble is, it's very hard to store antimatter because it reacts with matter.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you keep it away from the wall? So I think that's much ado about nothing. It's nice to know it's there. You'd want to be ready to study it. But I'm not worried about it. If somebody were to put me in a rocket up there, that would be a heck of a trip. I'd love it. I'm not going to worry about the antimatter.
Okay, so now that leads us, since you said if somebody put you in a rocket up there, that leads us to talk about the Van Allen radiation belts and the trips to the moon.
Yeah.
Did we go to the moon?
Yes.
All right, now...
We talked about radiation shielding for going to the moon way mm-hmm. back in the, when was it, the early 60s, when I was working at Aerojet General Nucleonics. Yes, we went to the moon. Again, the shielding is provided by the rocket, and you might want to be ready if there's a big solar storm at the wrong time to have sort of a hole to duck into with a little more shielding. But it's not like you're in free space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look how bright the sunlight is, but if you step in the shadow of something, it doesn't get to you, does it?
All right, so...
These things have to be taken in perspective.
With the Van Allen belts, we have a situation where we had one of the shuttles that got high enough that they were at the edge of the outer edge of the Van Allen radiation belts, and the astronauts in the shuttle began to see flashes of light in their eyes, and they were having all kinds of difficulty. But with the... with going to the moon, if they had traveled through the Van Allen belts, wouldn't it basically have fried them? Now, we have a break taking over, so we'll let you answer that on the other side of the break. And we will be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman, and I ask a loaded question just before we went to break. Wouldn't the astronauts going to the moon have been microwaved as they passed through the Van Allen radiation belt?
Not really. Microwave and particles are two different things.
Well, cooked. Wouldn't it have...
The microwaves are more like the X-rays and gamma rays that I was talking about.
Okay, well, let's forget microwaves.
Radiation.
Wouldn't it have fried them, the radiation of the Van Allen belts?
No. Radiation covers a lot of ground. There's particle radiation, there's electromagnetic radiation, there's light. Just because the light is bright doesn't mean you get cooked. Now, if that were X-rays or gamma rays, you're in deep trouble. But it isn't. We know what's out there, and yes, it does change with time, solar storms. And the astronauts have always worried about that. They try not to launch or do anything in a region where they will get much higher levels of radiation that could hurt them. But no, it's been way over emphasized. Oh, it's radiation. I hear that from people who think the same way about what happened in Japan and other places. My God, if I get radiation, I'm going to be cooked. Well, sorry, we're all getting radiation all the time, irradiated, if you will. sleep in the same bed with somebody for a year, and you'll each get a measurable dose of radiation from the other because we're all radioactive. That's the way life is.
Okay.
You know, it's the boogeyman, if you will, the bogeyman.
All right. Now, I have a partial answer to the question as well, but let me explore this, and then I'll give that partial answer and see what you think about it. All right. The when the shuttle got up on high enough that they were on the outer edges of the Van Allen belt, and the astronauts began to have problems, physical problems. They had the shuttle lower its orbit. So I think the question, and the reason I'm asking this is I have been asked this, and I do get asked it frequently. If that happened to the shuttle astronauts, how could the Apollo astronauts go through the radiation belt and survive
it? Takes very little time.
Okay.
It's how long a time, what the radiation level is per unit time, and how much time you spend in the place where the radiation level is high. And, you know, I worked around radiation. Yeah, if you're dumb enough to stand around while the reactor is cooking, you're going to be in trouble. But you have instruments to measure it, and you get out of the way. In other words, this is something you have to take into account. Just like outer space doesn't have any air, how could man be in outer space? He needs air to breathe. Well, he goes in a pressurized system, so he's provided with the air. If you get a big leak of the air in the shuttle, you're in deep trouble.
Yeah.
It's the same way here. There is a certain amount of radiation. You don't want to stay where the levels are high for very long. But if you're going to the moon, you get through that pretty darn quickly.
Well, here's my partial answer. They didn't go through the thick of the Van Allen belts. They left here. They left orbit, headed for the moon at a 30-degree incline from our equator. And sort of climbed out over the top of the Van Allen belts. They only went through the outer edges of it, not through the thick of it.
Well, even if they went through the thick of it, as long as they did it quickly enough, they're not in trouble. You get a bad sunburn? Well, it depends on how long you stay out in the sun.
And not me. Not me. I am glow in the dark white. I don't tan. I just fry. And so, just a few minutes in the sun, and I look like somebody that's been in the sun for a week. So, anyway, all right.
Well, how is it you were able to live here on this planet? You wear clothing to keep the sun away from your skin.
That's right, and I wear the required obligatory hat.
Sunscreen?
No, I don't wear sunscreen. I don't do that. Sunshades and shirts and, and plus I don't like hot weather, so I don't go out in it. And that's how I handle it. I control my environment. And that's what you're talking about. You're talking about controlling the environment to go through, it really is kind of like, I think, a submarine. You and I cannot get down as deep as these submarines do. And if we did, the pressure would crush us like a beer can. But the controlled environment of the submarine, people are down there living and working at great depths for long periods of time. And that's because they're in a controlled environment.
That's right. And you notice that it used to be we had submarines that were really surface ships that could stay underwater for maybe a day because they needed the air for the engine. Now they can go around the world underwater. They can spend a year underwater, which is quite remarkable, but because they're not burning air. can keep the air pretty clean if you're doing stuff right.
Mm-hmm.
But you're using the nucleus to produce the electricity instead of burning gas.
All right. So how long do you think it will be before we out here in the unwashed masses start seeing nuclear-powered spaceships in the news?
Well, in a sense, we already do. And like I mentioned, the Cassini spacecraft has a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, and all our deep space probes do, the Viking and the Vagabond.
Voyager?
That's the right name of it.
Yeah, the Voyager.
Voyager, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a Vagabond.
Yeah.
They all have, and the Pioneer spacecraft, they all have radioisotope thermoelectric generators, which use the energy of nuclear decay from plutonium-238, which scares the heck out of some people, but you can't build bombs out of 238. And that's how we managed to go out there. We're getting signals back still from several billion miles away. And, you know, that illustrates another one of these bad assumptions on people. There were some people early on who said, how can you put a man in space? You're going to have to communicate with him. And, look, we have radio stations here, 50,000 watts. How are you going to put a power plant that size in space? There's no way to do it. There's no way man will ever go up there. Well, we got smart. On the Pioneer spacecraft, and I worked on that in the early 70s, believe it or not, the transmitter operates at 8 watts. Not 50,000, 8 watts. But it's directed only back at the Earth. It's not blasting out in all directions. We use a big, big antenna down here, not your old rabbit ears kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Being smart is more important than being powerful. And the big advantage, of course, of the nuclear plant is that the further you get from the sun, the sunlight decreases in intensity.
Yeah.
That's not good. But the nuclear radioisotope, RTG it's called, technically, that output stays the same. Doesn't matter how far away. Important than being powerful. And when will we use nuclear rocket engines up there? When somebody has guts enough to do it. The nuclear navy, fortunately, had Admiral Rickover. And some people hated him, but the first nuclear submarine was operational in 1956. And there are hundreds of them around the planet. And think of all the fuel we're not burning, gasoline, you know, mm-hmm. diesel fuel, whatever they burn in ships. Because nuclear's taken over. Why would you build one that wasn't nuclear-powered, you know?
That's an excellent question.
So when will there be a rocket? We don't mm-hmm. have a need for it yet. But if you want to go to Mars, you could roughly triple the payload, double or triple the payload, if you use a nuclear rocket as an upper stage. More pounds per cubic foot of material. It's the simplest. More miles per gallon. How's that?
That sounds good. More miles per gallon. All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this, so don't go away. More with Stanton Friedman. All of the music used here at the Kevin Smith Show is from independent artists. Most of it from independent artists at musicalley.com. Go over to musicalley.com. Check out thousands of artists and thousands of great independent tunes. Musicalley.com. Thank you.
Dante Petrilla. Check out my new book, God's Will, but only if you're stout of heart. Intrigue, conspiracy, remote viewing, spirituality, and danger. It's a mix that makes this novel a page-turner. Click the link right here on the Kevin Smith Show website and enter Alec Candon's world called God's Will.
And now, the rock star of talk hosts, the man Gene Simmons would want to be if he could be a talk host. Here's Kevin.
Somebody slipped that one in on me. I didn't. Welcome to those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour of the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman, and we've been having a great time talking about a number of topics, and I have yet another one, Stanton, that I want to bring up before we open the phone lines. All right. But this one is all pretty much back down to Earth, and it gets over into flying saucers. Earlier this year, there was a man by the name of Command Sergeant Major James Norton who stepped forward. He began to tell his story about this battle that took place between UFOs, flying saucers, and the U.S. Army at Fort Benning back in the 1970s. Now, he's not the first person to tell that story. His story confirmed the story. It was confirmatory of the story of John Vasquez. And so, yeah, you know, every once in a while, Stanton, it sounds like you hang up. And someone is just interrupting the lines. We can all hear it. But then you come back online, so I don't know. But, yeah, it shows you're still there. Okay, so James Norton told his story here on this show, and it really sent ripples out. And then a couple of months later, he's back on the show. He tells us more of his story, which includes having been detained and threatened. Interesting, folks. You hear all that going on? You hear it? Okay. Notice that it really got bad when I started talking about James Norton. Notice that, because I think we've got some morons helping us out here tonight. But let me continue. James Norton told that story, and then about, you know, having been detained and threatened. And in the process of all of that, he also contacted Stanton Friedman. Stanton, are you able to hear me now? Well, folks, there you go. What more proof do you need, folks? You heard it. You heard it. What more proof do you need? All right, I'm going to hang up and try to see if I can... well, let me answer this phone call. Caller, are you willing to hang on for just a moment while we try to get Stanton Friedman back on the line?
Yes.
All right, hang on. And Stanton, are you on the line with me? No, you're not, are you? All right. Well, now that is interesting, to say the least. So we'll try to get Stanton back on the line here. And somebody doesn't want us to talk about Norton. You heard it. It's just, let me say to the morons, that's like putting yellow highlighter over everything I'm saying. And Stanton is, it's showing we have an active line, but we cannot hear Stanton. So I'm going to hang up. I'm going to try it one more time, and then we'll go forward from there. We'll see what happens. They're not going to let us make the connection. So I don't know. So if Stanton can hear me, perhaps he can give us a call at that number that we were on. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Okay, well, this is Ryan from Washington.
Uh-huh.
Did you want me to hang up and maybe see if you can get a hold of Stan that way, or?
Well, no. Let's just go ahead. Did you have a comment that you wanted to make?
Well, I wanted to ask Stan a question, but it apparently the morons are, and maybe we call study the silly effort to investigate. Maybe we can call Black Rose and. Not on my dime. We can call them silly effort to disrupt.
Yeah.
I'll get off the line, Kevin. I wanted to ask Stan a question. I wanted to ask Stan if you get him back on the line, Kevin, I'll just free up the line. I totally lost what I was going to talk about.
Well, let me ask you this. Could you hear all of that interruption going on the telephone line?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's quite obvious.
Same thing that happened with Robert Morningstar. Every once in a while, it cuts out and then comes back in.
Yeah. Well, this was just like somebody was disconnecting us, and now we're apparently disconnected. Okay. Well, I'll see if I can get him on this line, and we'll see what happens. Thanks for the call, Ryan.
Thanks. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. I'm telling you, folks, this thing with James Norton, that is hot. And there are people that don't want that to happen.
Hello?
Well, Stanton, I don't know what you think about stuff like that, but somebody cut us off and would not let us continue. And we could hear it. We could hear it happening.
And, wow.
But now I've got you on a different phone line. I'm on a different phone line. So let me go forward with the question about James Norton.
Yeah.
He got in touch with you. He had been on this show. He got in touch with you. Then he was on my show again and said that he had been detained and threatened. And now he's dead.
Yes.
What can you tell us about all of that? When he talked with you, where did that go? What was the outcome of his discussions with you?
Well, I was quite concerned that he was going public about having pieces of wreckage hidden away that hadn't been tested yet.
Mm-hmm.
he was sure is from an alien craft. But it seems to me that you do your tests first and then you make noise.
Mm-hmm.
You don't give the opposition a chance to get in the way, so to speak, to be polite about it.
Yeah.
So I was very worried about that, and I talked to some other people who were going to talk to him. I talked to John Vasquez and guy out in California and so forth. And I really don't know what the heck happened, whether he was sick when I first talked to him or what. And I don't know how legitimate the story is. In other words, I had talked to John Vasquez years ago about Fort Benning, and something certainly happened there. And it sounded like this guy had pieces of stuff, and boy, I when somebody tells me they got a piece of something, I want to get it to a lab.
Yeah.
Don't talk, but test, you know. Because then you've got the data, you've got a disinterested third party running a lab, and then you've got something worthwhile. That's always been my approach on this stuff. When you can get testing done, get it done first. Don't talk about it. there's a similar situation in New Mexico now with a professor at New Mexico Tech in Socorro who has run some tests on some small pieces of material, and I'm waiting for the next round of tests. But at least he wasn't talking before he'd run any tests. He had run some tests before he opened his mouth. So
well,
I don't know. The Norton story is weird, and I don't know where to go with that.
Based on the information that John Vasquez and I were able to run down, and part of this comes from family. He was feeling fine on November the 3rd, up till November 3rd. On November the 4th, he felt extremely weak, and he ached all over, and it was just so bad that he had them take him to the hospital.
Yeah.
And, of course, he never came out. And there was just this cascade, this constellation of serious maladies that one after the other were hitting him. He was diagnosed with cancer, and then he was diagnosed with leukemia, and then he was diagnosed with hepatitis C.
My goodness.
And then bone marrow turning to mush. And on the 20th, extreme swelling all over his body, and on the morning of the 21st, he was dead.
Sounds like somebody did something to him, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And, you know, and it's interesting. You know, all through our conversation tonight, you and I were getting interrupted a little bit. The instant I started talking about James Norton is when they really got serious with it and cut us off.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, what morons. If you want people to think there's nothing to it, then don't do things that draw attention to it, right?
Right.
And when they do this kind of stuff, and, you know, they cut the guest off and all kinds of things and interrupt the show. When they do that, yeah, it's frustrating for me, but my numbers go up. You guys are giving me free publicity because the whole world, 143 nations, hears you KGB types right here in the good old USA. They hear you doing that dumbass stuff, and they know for sure it's something they should pay attention to. And James Norton is something we should pay attention to. He's someone we should pay attention to. All right, so did you ever see any pictures of the material? Did he send you any pictures?
No.
He mentioned on the air that he had sent it to a lab. He almost told us where, and I said, no, don't tell that on the air.
Good for you.
And he said, well, okay, well, I'll just tell you what state. I said, no, don't even tell us what state. You know, you don't need to put that out on the air.
No.
And but obviously it got somebody's attention.
Yeah, I agree, and it's one of the weirder stories in all my 50-some years in ufology. I don't know what to make of it, but it's scary.
We had information from someone who is supposedly a friend of his that's been a friend for 20 years. And right after Command Sergeant Major James Norton died, we had this information. I had this information because I specifically asked the questions. And the information was that, so far as he knew, James Norton had never been in the Army, and that he was given to telling some pretty big stories, but they all just overlooked it because they loved him. And at first I thought, oh, man, don't tell me. Don't tell me that this was all hoaxed. Well, we kept checking, and what we found out was he was being buried at the VA Memorial Cemetery, Veterans Administration Memorial Cemetery. You can't do that if you're not a veteran.
That's true.
So the story that he never served in the military was not true. And so that was kind of a weird episode in all of this as well. Kind of weird.
Ufology is full of strange ones, but this is one of the stranger stories, I'll grant you that.
Well, you know, this kind of borders on the Paul Benowitz stuff, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's very similar to that. For those who don't know, Paul Benowitz was a guy that was telling some things publicly that obviously somebody didn't want, and he was suicided. And but this really is very, very much like that. But the guys that did this, I think somebody did it, but I can't prove that. If you did it, you just threw gasoline on the fire. It's something people are going to talk about forever now. I mean, that's how stupid can you get?
Yeah.
That's just stupid. And maybe that's why you have those jobs.
Could very well be.
Yeah. All right. What's hot for you right now in your research?
Well, there's several things going on. I'm looking forward this year to hopefully getting started on a movie, Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C.
Uh-huh.
There's a screenplay been written. It's had some good opinions from some big names in Hollywood. The story of me and of Don Schmidt and our trials and tribulations about MJ-12 and Roswell, and it should be a dynamic movie, you know, all the President's Men and JFK combined. And Richard Dreyfuss will play me. How's that?
Well.
He could do that. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, this is Hollywood we're talking about. But I do know that two big names have had good things to say about the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping to see a copy of it at the end of the month. That's one thing that's happening. A second thing is the same people are interested in making a movie of Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience. And it's a little tricky because of the movie that was on television with James Earl Jones, you know, and the previous book, The Interrupted Journey. But I think we see a contract coming. Now, in Hollywood, a contract is just, a license to look, so to speak.
Yeah, I know.
that could be good. I'm very excited about a couple of books that are coming out. Scott Ramsey and Suzanne Ramsey have done a great one on Aztec. And that should be finally out early in the new year.
All right, now, when you say Aztec
what?
Aztec is kind of the twin sister of Roswell, right?
Well, yeah, it happened in March of 48, and it had some people saying baloney about it right from the start, but Scott and Suzanne have done one. I've read the book and wrote the foreword, and I'm really anxious for it to get out and get rid of all the garbage that's gone on about Aztec. because there was an almost intact saucer that was recovered. And, you know, Roswell, you got a lot of pieces, but an intact saucer is going to get some people excited. So I'm looking for that book, and I just found out about another book that's really got me excited. I'll give you the title. What If It's True? The Science and Psychology of Extraterrestrial Contact. What makes the book important is that it's written by Dr. Don Dundery, Ph.D., was a professor at McGill University for decades in psychology. A gutsy guy, he's had a strong interest in UFOs for many years. And as a matter of fact, when I spoke at McGill the first time, I guess, he introduced me. Now, not many professors have guts enough to do that. And he also has a chapter in a book about abductions that came out a few years ago. And would you believe the Faculty of Science asked him to give a series of four lectures 2 years ago about UFOs? And so I've known Don a long time. We're both University of Chicago guys, and we were there at the same time. And so I've got the manuscript in front of me. It's 320 pages. I've just gotten started because I just got it in the last couple of days. But to have somebody as respectable as Don, he's retired now, but he's still an active person, this could really get people stirred up. And that's exciting. We need more scholars to do a good job on this subject. In contrast, there's an article on the Internet from Dr. David Clark of England, one of the debunkers over there, who makes a big noise in an article that just got published showing a picture of Major Jesse Marcel, and it's all balloon stuff, they say. Now, that's 10 years out of date, and it wasn't a balloon, and it wasn't a mogul balloon, and, you know, we got all kinds of testimony from all kinds of people involved. One of the DVDs on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, is Recollections of Roswell, which has testimony from 27 firsthand witnesses that we can't talk, most of them we can't talk to again because they're dead. And it makes the balloon explanation nonsense. But that never kept a good debunker down. I got to give you another story like that. You've heard of Incident at Exeter.
Yes.
Back in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And two debunkers have come up with an explanation. They don't know why nobody else ever thought of it. Of course, somebody else had. That was a refueling from a KC-97 and a B-47. This is something that was observed for more than 10 minutes over one small area, silently flying around. Did anybody ever hear of a KC-97 and a B-47 being silent?
Not exactly, no.
Less than 200 feet away, mind you.
Uh-huh.
But this is an article in the Skeptical Inquirer, and just ignore all the facts. And people had talked about refueling back umpteen years ago. It doesn't fit.
You know, now, the Skeptical fit. Inquirer, how much does it cost to subscribe to that magazine?
Well, I paid $6 for the one copy. They're doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about comparing that to toilet paper costs. You know, it might be a deal.
Might be a little more abrasive, and I don't know where that colored ink gets in the picture. They got a lot of advertising in there. But this was written by Joe Nickel and James Magaha. Magaha is a retired Air Force pilot. And they don't mention, of course, in the article that one of the witnesses spent 4 years in the Air Force, much of that time involved in refueling operations. But, of course, he wouldn't be able to tell that it was a KC-97 and an B-47. Well, their proof, of course, Pease Air Force Base is not far away, and they did have, on occasion, B-47s. Isn't that good enough? I mean, that's so typical of this kind of stuff. And I noticed that I've had my own experience in a sense. University of Chicago magazine editor called me 6 months ago, came here and spent 4 days here in Fredericton, New Brunswick, to talk to people that I know and so forth. And I'm a little worried about what kind of an article she'd do, but she did a great article.
Okay, Stanton, we have to step away for break. We'll pick up there with that article when we come back. And we'll try to reopen the telephone lines for you folks. I don't know if we're going to get opposition or not. It really doesn't matter much. We are still standing, and we shall continue to still be standing. But we'll be back right after this.
And you're listening to The Kevin Smith Show, also known as the world's hottest talk show host.
All right, welcome back. And we're going to attempt to open the telephone lines for you and see if we can proceed without interruption. The telephone number is 623-444-5889, 623-444-5889. Stanton, as we went away for a break, you were about to tell us a story. I had to interrupt you for the break, but the mic is yours.
Well, yeah, the response to this article in the University of Chicago magazine, which I was very pleased with, and everybody I know who's read it was pleased as well. But the next month, they published several letters from other alumni. The magazine goes to over 100,000 alumni of the University of Chicago. And some of these guys were off the wall. I was incredulous. These are all educated people. I take pride. The University of Chicago is a first-rate institution. Some of these guys had PhDs. And the false reasoning just got to me. We talked about fusion earlier in the program. And I had, fusion is mentioned in the article, and the guy says, well, the reason we haven't done anything about a fusion is because we can't build a fusion power plant here on Earth. And there's no connection between a fusion propulsion system for deep space travel and a fusion power plant down here. Entirely different situations. Another guy says, things are so far away, they're 1,000 parsecs. Parsec is 3.2 something or other light years. And why would anybody worry about 3,000 light years when we got Zeta Reticuli 39 light years away? And another guy writes in, well, how can you jump to alien spacecraft from just things that people see in the sky that they can't identify temporarily? As if there weren't, and he says, you know, if they were really here, we'd be seeing them on radar. Well, we do see them on radar.
Yeah.
It was a great lesson in the intellectual bankruptcy of the pseudoscience of anti-ufology, if you don't mind my getting fancy.
Well, I like that. I like that. That sounds great. That's some very good nomenclature there. All right, let's go to the telephone and caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, Kevin. This is Dean from Texas.
Hello, Dean.
A few questions for Dr. Friedman. I know you've been to Jackass Flat and up areas in Nevada, some of the secure areas. Are you familiar with the Charles Hall's tall white aliens, and have you ever seen anything that would back that story or any other aliens
in that area? I'm familiar with the story, but I haven't seen any evidence to back it up. So at best it's in my gray basket, maybe.
Okay. If you don't mind, another quick question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, what's your opinion of the Vasimir ion engine or other ion engines and its potential for interplanetary spaceflight?
Well, ion engines are being have been used. The Russians did one a number of years ago. They're okay within the solar system. You need a power plant for them. And remember that the Russians built 35 nuclear power plants that they put in space to provide power for radar and for all kinds of other things, and maybe a laser weapon system and who knows what. So you do need a good size power supply for an ion engine. It's not really the same as a fusion engine because, well, just look at the energy. The energy in fusion, the particles have about 10 million electron volts. The ions in the ion engines that are used much closer to Earth are in the, let's say, 20 to 50,000 volts. So the particles that are emitted have very much less energy than they would get in a fusion system. They'll work, you know, but they're not going too far with too big a payload.
Is there any possibility for a combination chemical rocket first stage and second stage ion?
Well, yeah, that's the idea, maybe third stage ions. Most people don't want to use, and for good reason, don't want to use fission or fusion, a nuclear first stage. Because if there's an accident on the pad, you gotta, you know, you're spreading radiation all over the place. So that's why you put it in a second stage or a third stage. When I was working on the nuclear rocket program, we were never talking about using it as a launch vehicle, but as an upper stage.
Yep. Okay, that's all I had.
All right, Dean, thanks for the call.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
623-444-5889, 623-444-5889, and if you have a question or a comment for Stanton Friedman, that would be the number to call right there. Let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Ryan again from Washington. I'll make it quick since I already called, and there's probably people trying to call in.
Yeah, well, that one didn't count because you didn't get to talk to Stan.
My question for Stan is, I read that the military is giving money to SETI now to investigate this new Earth, this new habitable planet that's 600 light years away. Why don't we, if there's
not
life
quite.
On Zeta... If there's life on Zeta Reticuli,
that's not what they're giving the money for.
Light years away, why are we wasting all our money going for something that's 600,000 light years away? And then also,
no, 600 light years.
I'll ask this and get off the line. What kind of environment do you think it is on Zeta Reticuli? What do you think is the environment there? I mean, what is it, hot or cold or what? I'll just hang up.
Well, I should go back.
The
military involvement in the SETI thing is more for the technology associated with the radio telescopes. It's not really to go after the planet that's 600 light years away. SETI has decided that now they're going to look for Keplerian satellites, planets that have been discovered by Kepler and so forth. I'm not going to throw darts at a dartboard, but I am going to say that when you have two stars that are sun-like that are a billion years older than the sun and that are only an eighth of a light year apart, so that each star is visible all day from the other planets around the other star, you'd expect that they'd get together. Even if there's only life on one planet around one of them, they're going to colonize the other in time. You know, there's a lot of people going to Las Vegas today. They certainly weren't 200 years ago.
Yeah.
And so with all that extra time available and the proximity of another place to go to, whether it's for colonization, migration, you know, maybe the penal colony for the other one, however you want to slice it. So I expect it's not too different from ours. And the kick,
Betty and Barney Hill both noted that it was kind of cool on board the craft. So maybe that would tell you something about what the surface temperatures are on the planets, you know, at the lower end as opposed to the upper end of the temperature scale. So I don't know. I'm not going to guess. But I do know that man can modify that. We call it terraforming. Make it suitable. That's why I mentioned Las Vegas. If you were there 200 years ago, you wouldn't say, going to be thousands of people coming here every day. You'd say, why would anybody come here? Hotter than heck and out in the middle of nowhere and nothing there. But we terraformed it. We made it suitable for life. I won't say intelligent life, but at least suitable for life.
So, well, yeah.
We don't know. That, there's an awful lot of guesswork here.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense to me that, I mean, my logic may be entirely off here, but it makes sense to me that if this planet, where you and I are right now, if this planet has been and is being visited, it's most likely being visited by those who are our closest neighbors, not our farthest neighbors.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, definitely, and especially ones that are older, if you will, than we are, because mm-hmm. they've got more technology. I mean, look at our technology 200 years ago. The planet's over 4 billion years old. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's one of the crazy things about this discussion about the 600 light-year away planet and stuff. We act as if nobody out there could have figured out that you can find planets in your neighborhood before we did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've known where the planets are for the last, you know, million years. Make it 10,000 only. I'll be generous, you know, conservative, me, but anyway. And we're not at the leading edge of the universe in terms of technology. You know, we're not the center of the universe, although people act as if we were.
So you actually, I mean, as far as you're concerned, it's pretty much an accomplished, confirmed deal, as far as you personally are concerned, that there is intelligent extraterrestrial life.
I'll go a step farther.
Okay.
Visiting here.
All right.
Yeah, it's not enough to say they're out there. The SETI guys say they're out there.
Mm-hmm.
They say they ain't coming here, buddy. If they were, they'd be talking to me. That's the attitude of the SETI guys.
Yeah.
And I say I can see why they would want to come here to keep us from going out there. We're a menace to the neighborhood. And despite the noisy negativists who think you can't get anywhere out there, remember we set off a fusion bomb 1952. 10 million times as much energy released as the 10-ton blockbusters from 10 years earlier. 10 million times. So we have set off 2,000 nuclear weapons on this planet. Fortunately, only two on people. But anybody in the neighborhood would say, these guys are a bunch of idiots. They killed 50 million people during World War II. 50 million people. These aren't civilized people here.
Mm-hmm. So you would...
Now, of course they'd be... They wouldn't treat us as equals.
All right, so these guys over at Zeta Reticuli, I take it that you're pretty convinced they have been here and are visiting here, right?
Yes.
Why?
Yeah, there's a whole chapter in the book captured about that.
Yeah, why would they do that if they look at us as being so primitive and dangerous?
Because being primitive... Now that we have the technology that could get us to bother them, it would be better to make sure that we don't leave to bother them.
Mm-hmm. So they're sort of like...
What we spend on reconnaissance.
So they're kind of acting like prison guards for us.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to put it, yes. Mm-hmm.
For the delinquents in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Look at the stories with the nuclear tipped missiles that have been shut down.
you know, like Malmstrom Air Force Base.
Yeah.
Or 10-minute man missiles with a saucer outside the gate go down one after the other. They're sending a message of some kind.
So where do you think this is headed? Well, tell you what, we'll get the answer to that question after this break. Folks, what'd you do? Sell your phone? We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Stanton Friedman, and you were about to tell us something when we had to go to break there, Stanton, so the microphone is yours.
I can't even remember what it was, but no, part of my concern is that so much of the discussion about extraterrestrial intelligence from the SETI guys entirely unwilling to look at what's coming here. They'd rather theorize about what's happening 600 light years away at a place that they know almost nothing about than deal with the enormous amount of evidence that indicates aliens are visiting. And I find that, you know, I'm going to be talking more to Don Dondry, the psychologist who wrote this new book that I mentioned, to try to figure out how can one explain people saying they're interested in extraterrestrial intelligence, but only out there? We don't want to look here.
Yeah.
Because if we're looking out there, all we deal with is signals. If we're looking here, we deal with people and their interactions with these things. They don't want to deal with that. That's not astronomy territory, I guess. So I'm really shocked by that. I would think
if
like
they
my,
find
classmates from the University of Chicago, that they would do a little more thinking before opening their mouths, facts
well,
in hand before putting mouth in gear.
SETI wrote the protocols that are used in the event that any kind of any evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence is discovered. There's a set of protocols that have to take place. All the astronomers in the world are part of that, the professional astronomers, because it's the protocols that will be used by the International Astronomical Union, which is funded primarily by the U.S. government.
The world?
All right, and everybody in the world gets notified, including the Pope, before us, and everybody that does get notified has a veto. All right, we have one more call, and let's take that call, and that'll just about take us to the end of the show. Caller, you're live on the Kevin
okay.
Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Well, this is John from Mesa, Arizona.
Hello, John.
How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, Stanton seems to be an intelligent man that might be able to answer this question, and bothered me for a number of years now, and it concerns the redshift of everything moving away from everything else in the cosmos. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, and like I say, I may not know enough to ask an intelligent question, but if...
Okay, but you need to go on and ask it because you're going to run out of time.
Okay. You've got hundreds of billions of galaxies, all with hundreds of billions of stars spewing forth stuff out into interstellar space, creating a lot of dust, for lack of a better term. Can this dust be part of the red shift of everything moving apart from each other, just like you see the sun is red in the sunset?
I would say I don't know. And I would say this is one of those areas of theory. Astronomers love to theorize about what's going on out there. Remember, we didn't know there was more than one galaxy until the 1920s.
I know.
Big argument about that. And so we are ignorant, but we don't like to admit our ignorance. Like I say, when you've had less than 200 years since technology got started, unless you go along with Bishop Usher that the world, everything was created in 4004 B.C., as opposed to 4004 or B.C., then we have to say that we're still ignorant. You can't learn everything in no time. Just look back. I was using a slide rule when I started work in industry. And many people don't even know what a slide rule is anymore.
I was afraid I was going to have to do it. It went out before I had to use it.
But you see my point, that our technology, I mean, I'm looking at a run-of-the-mill computer here. Do you realize how remarkable it is that I can be in touch with billions of people around the planet in no time? It's truly incredible, and it doesn't fill the whole room, you know.
I remember one that did when I was a kid.
We're getting there.
Okay.
Say that again?
Yeah, John. Go ahead and say what you said. You remember when there was a computer that did fill
rooms? I remember when ASU had a computer that filled several rooms, and all it did was basic math.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I am a little older than Kevin is, you know, a year or two.
Not possible. I was born the year after dirt was created. Anyway.
Oh, well, maybe it was the year of dirt for me. I don't remember.
Oh, mercy. Well, John, thanks for the call, man. I have to run because we're...
I'm older than both of you guys.
You were born before they had dirt. That's what that was.
Okay.
All right, John, thanks for the call. We have to run because we're just about out of time. Stanton, you've got some speaking engagements coming up you want to tell us about?
Well, just a few. I'm going to be taking a tour of the Southwest in April. It's all on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. I'll be in Roswell in early July. I'll be at MUFON in early August in Kentucky, well, across the river from Cincinnati. I expect there'll be more popping on my schedule any day. This past year was incredibly busy.
This thing in the Southwest, what are you going to be doing there?
We're going to visit Roswell, we're going to visit Los Alamos, and we're going to visit Trinity Site, where the first atom bomb was tested, and it's only open 2 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those days in April. It's on the website. I'll be on the bus with the people, and I'll give a talk in Roswell, and we'll stop by Los Alamos, plenty to see there, and so we'll also look around at White Sands. As long as we're there, what the heck?
Yeah, you're right.
It'll be fun.
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
Okay, so you still have slots open where people can get in on this tour?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The email address is on the website.
Well, and we have your website is linked. Folks, if you are at my website, you just click on Stanton's picture. It'll take you to his website, and all the information is there. So this is a tour that you are kind of heading up, right?
Well, I'm the live-in guide. How's that?
Yeah? Okay.
I'll be with him for about a week.
All right. And what's going to happen at Roswell? What are you going to look at Roswell?
Well, I don't know yet. I haven't written the new paper. Yeah, I'd like to spend some time, if the movie is gung-ho, talking about that, but also dealing with these phony arguments against Roswell. And every time I turn around, there's a new one.
Uh-huh.
People don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. That's what the debunkers are doing. And it's like they're going into overdrive. We can't have it be true. Anything but alien.
Yeah. Kind of odd, isn't it? Stanton, if you will, stay on the line with me for just a minute. And I want to thank you for being with us. I want to say to you also, Happy Hanukkah and Merry Christmas. And just stay on the line with me for a moment as we bring this in for a landing. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to wrap it up for this evening. Let me remind you, if you have not yet subscribed to our free weekly newsletter, you need to do it. All you have to do is get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. You'll see where it says K-Files right in the middle of your screen. You can't miss that. K-Files. Click it and subscribe, and you'll get an email immediately. And that email has a link in it that you have to use to activate your subscription. So do that, and you'll start getting the K-Files. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. Most people don't. Most people have been with us forever and stay with us forever. And we think you probably will, too. It's a great publication, and it's free. All right, so be sure you do that. And let me remind you that all week this week, because this is the week before Christmas, we're giving you something fun and free, and that is you get to watch our show free of charge every night, okay? It's always free to listen, but this week you can also watch. If you join, you can watch every night from now on, all right? Hope you do that. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.